Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Central Illinois and received a PhD in politics from Princeton. He received the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1977. He's America's most iconic and by far its most widely read political columnist, appearing in nearly 500 newspapers and penning a Newsweek column since 1976. We watch him weekly on the ABC TV program This Week. His true passion in life is baseball, and especially the Chicago Cubs. His name, George Will. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with America's most widely read political columnist, George Will. George, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
I'm glad to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I'm a Midwesterner, born in Champaign, Illinois in 1941. It's a bad year for the country, but a good year for me, where my father was a professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois, where he taught almost all of his career from 1938 until 1977, I believe it was, he retired. It was an idyllic place to grow up, had all the usual Midwestern experiences, riding everywhere in an uninhibited way all over the town and out into the country on a Schwinn balloon tire bicycle, from which I delivered the Champaign-Urbana Courier every night and Sunday mornings, a paper which, like a good many other Midwestern papers, is long deceased. A great place to grow up, played Little League Baseball, briefly and badly, for the Mittendorf Funeral Home Panthers.
What position?
Our color was black.
What position did you play?
Well, sometimes second base, but I was a born right fielder. That is, I was the person they put out where he could do least damage.
What did you learn from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad?
Well, both of them were educated people. My father, of course, was a professor, a PhD from Cornell University. My mother edited books, did indexes for scholarly publications, and was the editor of a children's encyclopedia published in Champaign, Illinois, called Our Wonderful World. So I think what I learned from them was the value of words and the necessity of reading. We were a household full of books and full of conversation, and it was good training for a columnist.
You went on to receive a PhD in politics from Princeton.
I did. I went to Trinity College in Hartford out of high school. Fine school, but I couldn't have gone there if there hadn't been a scholarship program set aside by an alumnus from Illinois, simply for Illinois students. Then I spent 2 years at Oxford, where my father had taught. Then I went to Princeton for 3 years and got a PhD.
Then you go on to teach political philosophy at Michigan State University.
Yes, I got to Michigan State in the fall of 1967, or as it is there known, or at least was then, the year after Bubba Smith. And the football team was good, and the students were fine. I lived in faculty housing on Cherry Lane Apartments. And I was there in the political science department, but that year, they started in Case Hall, a residence hall, they started a new college called James Madison College, which still exists and still thrives. So I was jointly appointed to the political science department and James Madison College.
How did you ever get started as a political columnist?
Well, a series of accidents. I left Michigan State and went to teach at the University of Toronto. And in the fall of 1969, Everett Dirksen, then the Senate minority leader, died. The Senate Republicans shuffled their leadership, and a senator of whom I had never heard, Gordon Allott of Colorado, became third-ranking Republican, chairman of the Republican Policy Committee, and he wanted to hire a Republican academic to do some writing for him. Well, in late 1960s, there were very few Republican academics. I was about it, and I was in Canada. But through sheer serendipity, he asked someone at the University of at Denver University, who, if he knew of any conservative academics. This person had been at Princeton in the graduate program with me. Gordon Allott got my name. He hired me, and that's how it happened. I went to work on the Senate staff for 3 years. I'd planned to leave at the end of 3 years anyway, but in any event, my senator lost, which, by the way, was not easy to do. It wasn't easy for a Republican to lose in 1972 when the Republican President Nixon was carrying 49 states against George McGovern, but we did it. We lost. And I had already called Bill Buckley at National Review, for whom I'd written a few occasional pieces, and I said, Mr. Buckley, you need a Washington editor of National Review. And Bill said, you're right and you're it. That's about how hard it was.
Growing up in Champaign-Urbana, a lot of Democrats at that time in Illinois, how'd you ever become a Republican and a conservative?
Well, the 2 years I spent in England helped a lot. I went there in 1972. The Berlin Wall had just gone up, and I went to Berlin and saw the Berlin Wall. And that's it was a very good, quick lesson in the stakes of modern politics and the dangers of the Soviet Union and communism. I was also, of course, living in England at the time and was very impressed by how the social energies of a great, dynamic people, the British people, were being, in my judgment, suffocated by excessive government, by statism, by the kind of watery socialism of the Labour Party and the not very different Conservative Party at that time. It was interesting, again, serendipity plays a large role in life. At about that time, well, actually in 1972, a 5-foot-tall economist at the University of Chicago named Milton Friedman, subsequent, of course, Nobel Prize winner, published a book called Capitalism and Freedom. And it was a galvanizing experience to read that book because it really showed the rationality and the justice of markets allocating wealth and opportunity as opposed to political decisions and the government allocating wealth and opportunity. So it was the coming together of practical historical experiences and intellectual experiences.
We're talking to George Will. When we come back, we'll ask him how he ever got his love for reading. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to George Will, who appears in nearly 500 newspapers 3 times each week. George, where'd you get your love for reading?
Well, I got it at home. I got it from two bookish parents. I got it from some particular writers. I wasn't bookish early on in my life. In fact, all I read was the sporting news and the backs of baseball cards. But I do remember, I don't know why I was reading it, but I think it was a summer between my junior and senior years in college, maybe between my sophomore and junior. But anyway, I was well into college. And I was in Champaign, Illinois, between years at Trinity College, and I read The Stranger by Albert Camus and was just transfixed, riveted by this book. It was, of course, at that time, young people were susceptible to the appeal of French philosophy, existentialists and all that. And Camus was, of course, an exemplary writer, but also an exemplary person, having been active in the French resistance during the Second World War. And this novel captured something that was in the air at that time. And I've been reading nonstop ever since.
How many books a week do you read today?
Well, a couple, two, three maybe, but I read and listen to. I'm absolutely addicted to audio books. For probably 30 years now, I've been listening to books on tape or on compact disc. 2 or 3 hours a day and otherwise wasted time. And I get up very early in the morning, about 5 o'clock, walk in to shave, hit the button, and I start listening to a book. I take my dog Madison for a walk before, while it's still dark, listening to a buck. I commute to work, to and from work, listening to a buck. In taxi cabs, listening to a buck. So I go through probably 50 to 70 books a year on audiobooks and otherwise entirely wasted time.
In the last year, what's been the best book that you've listened to?
Well, I'm going to surprise you. I just listened to it the other day. I'd say it's a book called The Ghost Map, and it's about the cholera epidemic that broke out in London in September 1854, and how a couple of amateur public health sleuths, if you will, in trying to track down the cause of it, almost invented epidemiology and pioneered all that was necessary before we could have a serious public health infrastructure for an urban society. It's a brilliant book.
1976, you get a job with Newsweek magazine. How did that ever happen?
Well, after I left the Senate staff at the end of 1972, I began a syndicated column distributed by the Washington Post and was writing for it happily when a very, very fine journalist, Stuart Alsop, who'd been writing on the back page of Newsweek, had died of cancer. Catherine Graham, who was then the publisher of the Washington Post company, which owns Newsweek, called me up and asked me to take over the back page, and I was reluctant to give up my column, so she solomonically split the difference. She said, well, Meg Greenfield, who is the Washington Post editorial page editor, would write one week and I would write the other week. So I kept my column and in the newspapers and adopted one in Newsweek.
And in 1981, you get on This Week on ABC TV. How'd that come about?
Well, there was in Washington in the late 70s, through most of the 70s actually, a group called, it was on the five Washington Post-owned and operated stations around the country. It was very popular in Washington, something called Agronsky & Company. Martin Agronsky had been in broadcast journalism forever, and he had a little half-hour weekly talk show that ran, I believe, on Saturday nights. And Rune Arledge, of the brilliant man who started out in ABC Sports and took over ABC News, a great innovator in television, fancied bringing something like that to television. He thought Sunday morning was the time for it. He thought that the Sunday morning formats were exhausted at that time. They were all only half an hour. He thought, actually, he wanted the Agronsky & Company conversational format featuring four or five journalists, and he just put on top of it interviews with officials. It was really the Agronsky & Company part of it that he wanted. So he said, we need an hour, we need the round table, as we now call it, and then we'll just tack some guests on the top, the traditional Sunday morning format. And that's how This Week started. Meet the Press soon afterward, responding to the competition, also went to an hour.
You've been in Washington, D.C. for decades. The animosity, the disdain between both sides of the aisle today, is there a solution for that?
Well, the animosity in Washington today is bad, but it's not unprecedented. The animosity in the 1790s, as our party system was just being formed, founders, of course, didn't envision parties. They thought of them as factions and things to be avoided, but we quickly sorted out into two parties. And in the sorting out, the vituperation became very awful, and the verbal violence at that time unprecedented. Remember the 1850s as the country was sliding into the irrepressible conflict of the Civil War, when Preston Brooks of South Carolina walked onto the floor of the Senate with his cane and beat nearly to death Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. Sumner was out of action for about 3 years. And Southerners were so pleased with this, they inundated Preston Brooks with gift canes. We've had terrible times before. I mean, there was a time at that period when someone on the floor of the House pulled a gun. His gun discharged accidentally, and six other people pulled guns. People were armed on the floor of the House at that time. So we've been through this before. right now it's a little bit hard to understand because objectively, it seems to me, the vituperation has increased as the differences between the two parties have decreased. We used to argue about whether or not there ought to be Social Security or whether or not there ought to be Medicare. Now we argue about the modalities for delivering these benefits. So it seems to me that just objectively, the great questions that used to divide us have been answered. We no longer argue in this country as to whether or not an African-American ought to be allowed to eat in a restaurant. These are all closed questions in our open society. But for some reason, as the differences have grown smaller, the vituperation has grown larger. Now, today there's one exceptional divisive issue, and that, of course, is the war in Iraq, a war of choice gone very badly. But I suggest to you, if you subtracted the war in Iraq, if it just disappeared, you'd still have a quite unusual and unpleasant degree of verbal excess.
We're talking to George Will, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1977. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with George Will. George, I marvel at times when a person of your ilk asks a question to a politician, how's the sun, you know, how's the weather? And they come back and they start giving you an answer about baseball. Totally different. When that happens, What do you tell them offline?
Well, I sympathize with the politicians. If they get up on a Sunday morning and come in to participate in our little programs in Washington, they're doing it because it's in their interests. That's the going-in assumption, and that doesn't offend me. If we ask question A and they give answer to a different kind of question, that's because they came on our program because they have something they want to say. And it's not our job to feel sorry for ourselves that they're going on to say it. It's our job to get them to say something they didn't want to say. That's just part of the game. And if they don't wind up saying something off their script, they don't want to wind up saying something they didn't come there to say, that's our problem, not theirs. It's our fault, not theirs.
When you criticize a politician and soon thereafter you run into them somewhere, what do they say to you?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I remember Meg Greenfield, the editor of former editor of the Washington Post op-ed page. She died a few years ago. And one of my mentors, as I began in this business, always told me that when she had had occasion editorially in the Washington Post to say something critical of a politician, and then she soon thereafter ran into one at a dinner party or reception, she made it a point of walking straight across the room, her hand extended, and shaking hands with that person. It's very important to people in Washington to bear in mind, remember, that this is not personal, that the honorable, decent men and women of goodwill can disagree about very important matters and remain civil about it. Now, we've lost sight of that a little bit in Washington. I just the other day had lunch with Chris Dodd, Democratic candidate for president. We had a marvelous time talking about lots of things. His father, who was a prosecutor at the Nuremberg tribunals and later senator, about current issues. And we amicably talked and amicably disagreed and went away. And I got a note from him, handwritten note a few days later, saying how much he'd enjoyed a conversation like that and lamenting. He said that used to happen in Washington all the time, his implication being that it doesn't any longer. And again, it goes back to something you asked about a moment ago, which is the verbal excess in Washington, the temperature that needs to be lowered. We need to turn down the thermostat. I don't quite know how to do it, but one way of doing it is when you criticize someone, you walk across the room and shake hands with them.
We're talking to George Will. When we come back, we'll ask him who's the favorite guest he's ever had on. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with George Will. George, of all the hundreds, thousands of guests you've had on, who's your favorite?
That's easy. That's Pat Moynihan, senator from New York, a very good friend of mine toward the end of his life, probably my best friend. Pat was, well, they just don't make Pat Moynihans anymore. He was a scholar of great distinction, fully conversant with all the arguments in sociology. A man who knew that of all the things Marx got wrong, the one he most got wrong was his assertion that with the coming of modern, rational, scientifically based industrial society, the two formerly great drivers of history, religion and ethnicity, would no longer drive history. Moynihan said, on the contrary, religion and ethnicity will be more powerful than ever with the disappearance of the great fighting ideologies of the 20th century, fascism, communism, socialism, etc. Turned out he was exactly right. He had a great sense of that in foreign policy and in domestic policy, of how complicated a modern society is and how hard it is for government to do anything without triggering the law of unintended consequences, which is that the unintended consequences of a government action are apt to be larger than and contrary to the intended consequences. So Pat, because he was so educated and because he was so witty and because he was so articulate, was on any subject, foreign or domestic, the most lively, illuminating, and plain fun guest you could have.
If you could name anyone currently living in America to be the next president, business leader, church leader, politician, who would you name?
Well, you're inviting me in your question to go beyond the political class, but I'm not going to do that, because the presidency is ultimately, thoroughly, a political job. And politics, like baseball, like poetry, is a learned profession. It takes a long immersion in the craft to get it right. So I'm going to pick someone from among the politicians, or those who have been politicians, and I think I'll surprise you a little bit. I don't see anyone out there on the horizon that excites me the way Pat Moynihan, whatever, or my old friend Scoop Jackson, the late senator from the state of Washington. But I do think that there's a man down in Georgia, former Senator Sam Nunn, who's given an enormous thought to the problems of national security, particularly an enormous amount of thought through the Nunn-Lugar program that he and Senator Lugar put in place before he, Sam Nunn, left the Senate, to take care of loose, unaccounted-for Soviet nuclear weapons. I don't think anyone is more conversant with the problems of protecting us against that ultimate danger of loose nuclear materials than Nunn. He'd be a good choice.
You have four children, and one, John, who was born in 72, has Down syndrome. What has John taught you?
Well, bravery. I mean, he just goes through his life day by day. People are unfailingly nice to him. He has trouble articulating, and his speech is not as understandable as you'd like or as he would like. People are unfailingly patient with him. He's born in 72. He's 35 years old. I can't think of three bad experiences he's had in 35 years. Gets his way around Washington on the public transportation, on the metro. He's got season tickets to everything that moves in the way of sports. He works in the clubhouse of the Washington Nationals National League team. Courage, that's what it can't be easy for him, but he does it.
I've marveled, George, most every family that's been blessed with a special needs child, they refer to that child ultimately as their hero, an angel, their teacher, inspiration. Why is that, George Will?
Well, because again, much is less has been given them and more is demanded of them. And they rise to the challenge, that's why.
You've said football is a mistake. It combines the two worst elements of American life, violence and committee meetings. And you believe that baseball's the greatest sport. Why?
Well, as to football, I don't think the human body's made for that kind of violence. I think that the committee meetings I referred to, of course, are huddles. I don't probably need to tell Detroit Lions fans that football's a mistake. They should try something else and go out to Comerica Park and see the real game. But why baseball? It's, first of all, it's the right game for a democracy. Democracy is a system in which you settle for half a loaf. No one gets all they want. Same's true in baseball. The best team in baseball in a given year walks off the field beaten more than 60 times in a normal year. Going into a baseball season, every team knows it's going to win 60 games. Every team knows it's going to lose 60 games. You play the whole season to sort out the middle 42. It's a severe meritocracy. Football teams play 16 games. Sometimes the best team doesn't wind up on top. In baseball, after 162 games, the good breaks and the bad breaks even out. Hot streaks come, cold streaks come, slumps come, luck happens. It all evens out in the end. Over 162 games, the best team wins. And that's baseball. Besides, it's extraordinarily pretty.
There was a very famous book on baseball, The Boys of Summer. And in 1990, you write a baseball book entitled Men at Work. Why that title?
Well, in part, it was a response to The Boys of Summer. I wanted to write a book. Well, first of all, I wrote it because no one had written it for me. I wanted a book that would explain what the heck was going on out there. People had always said, you know, baseball's slow. I felt, and indeed I think in my book I proved, that baseball is extraordinarily fast. Once you understand about all the decisions that are being made, adjustments that are being made, pitch by pitch, out by out, you're amazed at the amount of information these men are processing. Second, baseball is played by men, grown men. It's demanding, it's dangerous, it's their livelihood. These are not boys, and this is not play. This is work, beautiful work, and they love to do it. Most of them would do it if they weren't paid to do it.
In
but
that,
book, but
in,
again, these are men at work, and it's dangerous work.
In that book, was on the bestseller list for months. You profile Cal Ripken for defense, Tony Gwynn as a batter, Oral Hershiser as a pitcher, and Tony La Russa. What do they have in common?
They illustrate the central thesis of the book, which is that mind, thought, is very important in baseball. That baseball, more than any other sport, is a sport in which your enjoyment of the game arises sharply with your knowledge of the nuances of the game. You can enjoy football, just the sheer spectacular violence of it all, even if you don't know anything at all. You can enjoy basketball, the sheer balletic beauty of these enormous men performing so gracefully, even if you know nothing about the subtleties of basketball. In baseball, it helps enormously to understand the tiny adjustments, the farsightedness of the players that goes into a winning team. And that's why I wrote it. And that's why it's become, I believe, the best-selling baseball book of all time.
We're talking to George Will, who's a phenomenal Chicago Cubs fan. We'll talk to him about that when we come back. I'm Jack Brasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with George Will. George, when you and I were together at Cooperstown a couple weekends ago, and I said, you know, we both love the Cubs, you opened your cell phone, and there was the logo on the cell phone. Why? You know, you talk about the Lions have waited 50 years. That's still diapers. We've waited a century, 99 years. Why?
Well, you know, once you start waiting, you can't give up. I just know that if I said, I can't stand it anymore, I'm going to become a Washington Nationals fan, the Cubs would win the next year. But it's beyond that. As you know, as every real sports fan knows, there's something tribal, visceral, irrational about the attachment of a person to their team. And it's the fun of it, is the very irrationality of it. The very fact it doesn't mean anything other than itself. Furthermore, you know, I became a Cub fan at age 7 in 1948. That year the Cubs were so bad that the Cubs management, Mr. Wrigley of chewing gum fame, the owner, took out ads in the Chicago papers to apologize for the team. I still became a Cubs fan. Phil Cavaretta, Andy Pafko, Eddie Mixis, Gene Hermansky, all these names. I mean, how many people have played for the Cubs since I've been a fan? Thousands. And still I hang in there.
You know, we tried that. The rotating manager is the one year in 64 or whatever.
The College of Coaches. The College of Coaches. What a dumb idea that was.
So I have a very good friend in Chicago, and above his TV, he's got that famous picture of Norman Rockwell, you know, with the fans booing the Cubs.
That was 1948, by the way. Rockwell painted that in 1948.
And Tom and Maureen have that, and he has a little plaque on it, and he's entitled it May. That by May, we know we're out of the thing. So.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they used to say that Cubs' June swoon came in May.
You wrote a book with a happy eye, but America and the World, 1997 to 2002. And you said in that book, on celebrating your 60th birthday, quote, "It's taken me 60 years to identify the three keys to a happy life: a flourishing family, hearty friends, and a strong bullpen."
Well, someone has to get outs 25, 26, and 27. If you don't have a strong bullpen, nothing else in life matters.
You wrote a book in 98 entitled Bunts. What's the theme of that book?
Well, that was a whole collection of things I'd written about baseball over the years, ranging from Pete Rose, Camden Yards, and the architecture of baseball, the villains, Pete Rose, the heroes, Kirk Flood. Baseball is like everything else. It's got heroes and villains and mediocrities and good architecture and bad architecture. And it's just an entirely rich field of life to immerse oneself in when you can't stand another 10 minutes of politics.
Michigan is in a transformation. We've lived for decades with the union, the entitlement culture that we've had, and those days are gone. Talk to us about the inevitability of change in life today.
Well, change is the only constant in life. It's a paradox. It's an ancient philosopher named Heraclitus said you can't step into the same river twice. The river changes. Everything changes. And Michigan is going through particularly wrenching changes because no sphere of modern commerce has been more characterized by intense competition than the automobile industry, and no industry in modern life, thanks to the strength in 50 years ago of the United Auto Workers, no industry has been more transformed into a, if you will, a private sector welfare state than the automobile industry. And just as the welfare states the world over are beginning to buckle under the strain of an aging population, so too the automobile companies are buckling under the weight of their legacy costs, particularly for the medical costs for their retirees. So Michigan's going through these wrenching changes, but it's just amazing to me the resilience of American communities in picking themselves up, dusting themselves off, and going on. And Michigan will do that, too. You know, I used to, as a young man, my family used to vacation 2-3 weeks every year over in Whitehall, Michigan, Whitehall, Montague, two communities side by side on White Lake, just north of Muskegon. So Michigan is not just the automobile industry. It's not just the United Auto Workers. It's a big, complicated, robust, high-achieving state, great universities and all the rest. Michigan will be just fine.
Are you hopeful about America's future?
Oh, of course. America is, you know, they said the 20th century was the American century, the name given it by Henry Luce of Time magazine. Well, it was the American century. I think 21st century will be even more so, because the American nation, more than any other, can accommodate immigration, can accommodate that infusion of fresh life and talent into our society. It is comfortable with change, with markets, with all the creative destruction of capitalism that is does involve destroying some old things, but is ultimately creative. So America, by its culture, by its values, by its historical experience, is better poised than any other nation for the increasing velocity of change in this new century.
Global warming. Who's right?
Well, goodness, it seems to me not counterintuitive that the temperature of the globe is warming. After all, there was a time when Greenland was farmed and there were forests on Greenland. The temperature was so warm. The temperature was so cold once that there was 3 feet of ice in the Thames River. We've had global periods of global warming, periods of global cooling. We're now in a warming period. It's not very dramatic. It could be that burning carbon fuels contributes to this. I would just say let's not get the politics, the response to this, ahead of the science. The science is still very tentative. And it's not clear that however much we impose costs on ourselves, impose inefficiencies and all the rest, it's not clear that we're going to have a measurable impact.
Globalization. What are your thoughts?
Globalization simply means the coming of freedom to the movement of peoples, goods, services, capital, and ideas. And that's a good thing. Again, it has dislocations. Globalization is one of the problems that has swept over Michigan with the internationalization of the automobile markets. But again, what's the alternative? Do you really want to live erecting barriers, trying to prevent change? When one of the good things that President Bill Clinton once said when he rejected protectionism, he says, protectionism is just another way of saying, I give up. We don't give up.
Final question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, the advice is implicit in what I said at the top of our little discussion here, and put it in one four-letter word, read. I believe not just that ideas have consequences, but that only ideas have large and lasting consequences, and that books, for all the talk about the Internet and the blogosphere and podcasts and cable television and satellites, for all the new technologies, all the new media, I still think that what began with Gutenberg, movable type and the book, books are still the primary carriers of ideas in our society. Read.
George, I want to say, for all of America, thanks for all you do. Thanks for the values you hold and the great ability that you have explaining those values to us.
Well, it's an immense privilege to be able to have this ongoing 40-year conversation with the American people who are very good readers and very good to hear from.
Thank you. Our guest next Sunday will be the co-founder and president of Atlanta Data Services, Bill Gallagher. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoh.